And now, The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Thursday, March 28th, 2024, 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Temin. Our producers are Eric White and Peter Masurlian. Our digital editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up in this hour of The Federal Drive, how to do foreign aid without stepping on federal toes. Plus, new rules take effect for agencies buying from Ability One contractors. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of The Federal Drive. But first, speaking of rules, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency released sweeping cyber incident reporting regulations yesterday. These are proposed rules. They would apply to hundreds of thousands of companies across 16 critical infrastructure sectors. The goal is to identify dangerous hacking campaigns that threaten everything from oil pipelines to hospitals. Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday joins me with the latest. And this rulemaking was anticipated, correct?
That's right. It's been anticipated for 2 years now. It was in March of 2022 that Congress passed the Cyber Incident Reporting for Critical Infrastructure Act, otherwise known as CERCIA. That's a fun acronym that you'll hear tossed around. CISA has spent the last 2 years developing these sweeping rules. The notice of proposed rulemaking is 447 pages, so it is extensive. By contrast, the Pentagon CMMC proposed rules were only about 230 pages, and that's not a simple rule itself either. It goes into how exactly this will work across 16 critical infrastructure sectors. A couple of the highlights is that there are about 316,000 organizations that CISA estimates this will apply to one day across those critical infrastructure sectors. And it expects in the first year of these rules becoming effective, which is projected to be 2026, it will receive about 25,000 cyber incident reports under the rules. So that's a lot of data, a lot of organizations that are going to be captured by these rules.
Which entities will have to report within a given sector?
Yeah, so the way that they scoped the covered entities, as they're called in this rule, was pretty important. It was one of the more closely watched things. What they're doing is they're defining those covered entities as any within one of the 16 critical infrastructure sectors that exceeds the small business size standards set by the Small Business Administration. So big is one of the big parameters here. And then outside of that, any of the critical infrastructure sectors, entities that fall within sector-specific criteria that CISA sets in these rules. And that's one of the reasons this is so long, is across those 16 sectors, there's specific criteria. I'll pull one out as an example. In the IT sector, CISA is going to require any entity that provides hardware, software, or services to the federal government to require, is going to require them to report cyber incidents. That's just one example of sector-specific criteria.
And lest they get completely inundated with everything that happens every time you have a buffer overflow, what types of incidents are covered under the rules?
Yeah, that's right. CISA made it clear that they wanted to set a high threshold to prevent over-reporting, to make sure that routine or minor cyber incidents do not need to be reported. And so they've set kind of four broad parameters here for what kind of incidents need to be reported to CISA. The first parameter is when there's a substantial loss of confidentiality, integrity, or availability of an organization's system. So your internal network gets hacked and your whole internal system goes down. The next parameter is serious impact on the safety and resiliency of operational systems and processes. This is particularly important when you're talking about, you know, dams or water systems or something like that where there are control systems in play. The third parameter is the disruption of the ability to engage in business or industrial operations. There's been multiple ransomware hacks where, you know, maybe business systems were hacked, but then it resulted in an inability of the business, Colonial Pipeline, for example, to provide services. And finally, the last is unauthorized access, so hacking caused by the compromise of a cloud service provider, a managed service provider, or a third-party data hosting provider, aka a supply chain compromise. CISA wants to know about those as well.
Basically, when there's real damage to some aspect of operating. And how is this actually going to work in practice? Because they need some codified way or some kind of a standardized way. Otherwise, it's, you know, 1-800-TELL-CISA.
Yeah, that's right. They go into the rule. They talk about a web form that they're going to put out there. So unsurprisingly, cyber incidents are going to be reported over the web and not, you know, you're not going to walk up to your local CISA office. And this web form will be released when the final rule is released about 18 months from now. So this, again, is just a proposed rule, and CISA is going to get a whole lot of comments, go through them, adjudicate them, and then release some of the, you know, technology infrastructure that's going to support that in a couple of years.
It sounds like just the mere reporting and the requirement to do that is a little bit less onerous than some of the rules coming, say, for CMMC, where you have to have certain controls in place, prove them, attest to them, have somebody third party go say, yeah, you're okay, you're kosher. This seems a little bit less of a regime, maybe.
That's right. I think, you know, it's important to note that this isn't giving the government or any sort of third party access to systems and, like you said, sort of complying with any standards or anything like that beyond just telling CISA, reporting to them certain information, indicators of compromise when you have some sort of cyber incident that meets the parameters that we've already discussed. At the same time, these are very sweeping rules affecting hundreds of thousands of organizations across the country, and they're going to have to make some, you know, game time decisions as these incidents are unfolding in terms of, does it meet the parameters, and hey, what do we have to tell CISA here under these rules?
And is it considered a major rule in terms of cost, such that it has to go up to the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs?
That's right. It had to go through OIRA review, and so it actually spent the last few months going through that review before CISA released the notice.
And what are the teeth? That is to say, penalties if you don't report something, and then all of a sudden your customers are locked out.
Yeah, the main teeth in this rule is the subpoena power that CISA has. They can issue a subpoena to any organization that doesn't comply with the rules. Now, CISA will start out by, if they suspect, you know, you're a water system that was hacked and you haven't told them anything yet, they're going to issue what's called a request for information, a little less, you know, perhaps aggressive than a subpoena. But then if you don't respond to that, or you don't respond to that adequately per these rules, CISA says that it will issue a subpoena. And if you don't respond to that, then CISA says it will refer you to the Attorney General for potential civil action. For government contractors, this is also interesting. The rules lay out the potential for suspension and debarment if that might be the case where you're a government contractor who doesn't report a cyber incident. And then there's also the False Claims Act. If you lie or otherwise misrepresent what's happened in an incident, that also comes into play here.
I guess a failure to report could be construed as a false claim in some sense.
Yeah, failure to report or you know, saying, hey, this wasn't that big of a deal, and then it comes out 6 months later that actually was.
And we've talked earlier that there's OIRA has been reviewing lots of rules. There's DOD rules coming out. There's GSA possible cybersecurity regulations. Is anybody like OIRA somewhere, OMB, saying, can we get all this kind of harmonized in some kind of a system that's cogent for the tens of thousands of entities that are going to have to bear the cost?
Yeah, that's a key watchword, harmonization here. CISA and the Department of Homeland Security say they are committed to harmonizing these rules with other regulations out there. There's a DHS Cyber Incident Reporting Council that pulls in a whole lot of federal agencies, and that's kind of the main avenue through which this harmonization will happen. And in this proposed rule, CISA says it will seek to create an exception where if substantially similar information is reported to another federal entity, then they will say, hey, you're okay, you don't have to report to us under our rules. And the important thing there is that CISA has to set up some interagency agreements to make sure that they at least know when something happens. So that sort of interagency behind the scenes sort of minutia will be pretty important to watch here as well.
Well, we know what people are going to be reading over Easter weekend. What's the comment period and what's the schedule for this rule?
Yeah, the rule actually formally gets published in the Federal Register on April 4th, but you can read it now, as you said, and comments are due by June 3rd, so stay tuned.
Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And be sure to check out his story at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come, new rules take effect for agencies buying from Ability One contractors. This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to The Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. New rules have taken effect for procurement from Ability One contractors. Those are the companies, mostly nonprofits, whose employees have disabilities. The rules were ordered by Congress back in 2017, and they do bring some more competition into the program. Joining me with an update, the executive director of the Ability One Commission, Kim Zeik. Ms. Zeik, good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
So what's going on with my old tried and crude Ability One program? Tell us about the new rules and what they require of agencies now going ahead with the procurement from the Ability One contractor set.
The Ability One program provides employment opportunities to individuals who are blind or have significant disabilities through the federal acquisition system. Historically, the Ability One program has been an exception to competition in contracting. So the U.S. Ability One Commission announced a new final rule supporting competition in the Ability One program. It is limited competition, and we'll talk about that, but it does deliver on a top priority of that congressional oversight panel.
Right, because of the wage structures and the nonprofit, I believe, status of many of the companies, you don't want them chasing lower and lower prices all the time, and yet you want competition. So how does it actually work then?
The final rule strikes a balance between those important objectives, between meeting our government customers' expectations for best value on Ability One contracts. At the same time, the final rule helps us advance the Ability One mission by taking into account employment and career mobility for individuals with disabilities as factors in the competition.
And how does it do that? What are some of the strictures now that agencies have to follow?
A typical competition involves, of course, technical proposals, past performance, and consideration of price. So when the Ability One Program Commission approves a competition, these will be limited to the largest contracts in the Ability One program. The commission will consider those factors, but at the same time, the commission will consider and reward what we call mission-related factors or the social impact of the Ability One employer. So that means the commission will look at training, it will look at career mobility, and it will look at the overall employment opportunities that an Ability One provider brings to the table, in addition to, again, the traditional competitive factors.
Well, does the commission stand in between the requisitioner, the acquiring agency, and the contractors?
The commission will have an important oversight role. The commission will approve a request for competition. Those will be limited. One of the safeguards that we have built into this rule is who can request a competition. So that will come from a high level in the organization, in the customer organization. That will come from a senior executive or a general officer. The commission will look at our suitability criteria before approving a competition. And then the commission will ensure, again, a balance of factors. So technical, past performance, price, and that social impact that we will look at in terms of the career opportunities for people with disabilities.
And do you expect most of the requests for competition to come from, say, the Defense Department?
Well, the Department of Defense is the largest Ability One customer. The Department of Defense has been requesting the opportunity to have competition. So we foresee some requests will come from DOD. At the same time, we have a lot of civilian agencies who are our customers as well. And so the final rule, in fact, takes that into account. It sets a dollar threshold for DOD that is different from our civilian customers. So only, again, the largest Ability One contracts, whether coming from defense customers or civilian, will be eligible for competition.
What are those dollar thresholds?
The threshold for defense contract is $50 million total contract value. So that's $10 million annual value. For our civilian customers who tend to have smaller contracts, it's a $10 million total contract value threshold, so $2 million per year.
Got it. And these are often not high-priced types of items that they're buying. I mean, there are items in Ability One, but there's also services too, correct?
And the competition rule applies specifically to Ability One service contracts. So we perform a wide range of services. Where I see the competition rule coming into play would be your large base support operations contracts where Ability One may handle the public works for an entire military installation. Could also come into play for some of our civilian contracts where we have perhaps total facilities management of a large building complex.
We're speaking with Kim Zeik. She is executive director of the Ability One Commission. And what has been the reaction so far, or the acceptance of this, not that they have much choice, on those services contractors?
The final rule that was just published March 22nd, and it reflects extensive stakeholder engagement. It directly responds to, I would say, adopts and adapts the public comments that we received. So the commission expects our stakeholders to feel more comfortable with the final rule than they did with the proposed rule. We heard a lot of feedback. We've taken about a year since the initial rule was proposed to go through all of those comments, all of those recommendations, and to come out with a final rule that we think achieves the balance all of our stakeholders are looking for, whether they're customers or Ability One employers.
So you got comments from the Ability One companies and also from the federal agencies?
Correct. We received well over 100 comments. We had listening sessions in addition to the opportunity for the public to submit written formal comments. And those were taken into account. So the final rule, I would say, was informed by and improved by the public comments.
Now, this, I understand, was ordered up by Congress in the NDAA back in 2017. What took so long?
You're absolutely right. The 2017 National Defense Authorization Act established an oversight panel to recommend improvements in the Ability One program. So the panel took about 4 years to make a large number of recommendations and to review the commission's progress in implementing the recommendations. And the panel reached its sunset point a couple of years ago. We began working on this rulemaking process. The notice of proposed rulemaking was published about a year ago. So establishing regulations is a time-consuming process, particularly if you have broad comment, you know, and public outreach process, which the commission sought to implement here. And probably rulemaking should take time. I would say the rulemaking process worked the way it's supposed to in this case, because we did listen to the stakeholders and adopted and adapted so many of their comments in the final regulation.
And how does this all square this idea of competition, and there is a price element in there, when the Ability One, as I understand it, contractors are on a drive, if you will, to get wages up to the minimum wage level, which has been kind of a sticking point for the people that are employed, because they are people, even though they have disabilities. And so more and more of them are receiving at least the federal minimum wage. So wages are generally higher. Can this all square?
It does all square. It is all part of how the commission has been working to modernize the Ability One program. For the past year, we've been pleased to say that everyone in the Ability One program working on Ability One contracts will earn no less than the federal minimum, state minimum wage, or the prevailing wage, which on federal contracts tends to be much higher. Our average wage in the Ability One program is over $18 an hour on our Ability One service contracts. And the competition rule applies within and among Ability One employers. So we have a level playing field. Everyone who will be subject to or eligible to compete in a competition will be paying the same wages.
Understood. Okay. Yeah, that is an important development. And what about modernizing in terms of the range of disabilities? You mentioned blindness first, and I think that's kind of the grandfathered in condition that gave rise to Ability One. But in performing services, facilities, maintenance, janitorial type of stuff, then probably blind people can't do a lot of that type of work. So the range of disabilities incorporated, has that also been expanding?
The Ability One program does serve a very diverse population among those who are blind, visually impaired, or have significant disabilities. So many of our program employees, and I would say there are almost no limits to what individuals who are blind, visually impaired, or have significant disabilities can do within the program. But we certainly have a population that encompasses people with intellectual or developmental disabilities, individuals who may have mental health disabilities, as well as those with physical disabilities, hearing loss or deafness, just a very broad range of disabilities. And what we see on these large Ability One contracts, there's often an opportunity to employ people with a very diverse set of skills to provide them with the supports and services they need to be successful on the job.
Kim Zeik is Executive Director of the Ability One Commission. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
And we'll post this interview along with a link to the rule at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, how to make sure you outlive your investments after you retire. But first, how to do foreign aid without stepping on federal toes. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. A large nonprofit has been obtaining Tesla battery packs and getting them into Ukraine for when Russia knocks out the electricity. I was curious about how an operation like this works. How does it maneuver around military operations and stay on the good side of the State Department and other agencies that may be operating there? I spoke with the president and CEO of Direct Relief, Thomas Tighe.
Well, Direct Relief is providing a lot of medical material aid to Ukraine, but the most recent activity has been a significant investment of over 2,000 battery systems to backstop the Ukrainian health system. That was their priority. And, you know, like any health system, when the power goes out, it's unable to function and perform the basic services. And that was the priority. So it was what Direct Relief stepped up and has done this month. I think as we've continued over $1 billion of medical material aid since the war began, this power issue has become an emergent crisis, really, for the Ukrainian healthcare system as they're deep into the war now.
And maybe give us a little bit of background on the organization itself, Direct Relief.
Well, Direct Relief is a nonprofit humanitarian healthcare organization that works in all 50 U.S. states and about 100 countries each year. Its principal focus is to provide medical material, medications, vaccines, medical supplies that are needed but can't be afforded by the people who need them. So that's the typical role that Direct Relief has played for 75 years. We're secular, entirely privately financed, and an apolitical organization. So it's just purely a humanitarian healthcare organization. And Ukraine has been the largest single effort that we've undertaken in 75 years just because of the need and the proximity to Europe where we're set up and have been able to provide a lot. But this entry into the power sector, at least for health, is something that's relatively new for Direct Relief. We see it much more typically in the aftermath of an emergency natural disaster like Hurricane Maria. But increasingly, we're all becoming more dependent on power for the medical devices, either at home or in a facility, while power is becoming less reliable, more frequent outages, often brought about by climate issues, but the Ukraine obviously brought about by a different cause, but same effect on health.
Sure. And when you are maneuvering, say, to get these devices, these battery packs into places like Ukraine, let's talk about on the civilian side and really on the work around the world. How do you maneuver around, say, USAID or official organs, governmental organs that are trying to help out there, State Department?
Yeah, we've been very careful. We, you know, always notify the State Department, the embassy in whatever country we're working in as a courtesy, just to make sure that they're aware of what Direct Relief is doing. It's often filling a gap that cannot be filled by either the private marketplace or by any government. But as an American organization, we think it's important to make sure that the American policymakers are aware of what we're doing. It's no desire to do anything offline. It's just we don't receive government funding, but work very closely and in coordination with. And if we get a signal that it's not needed or otherwise complicating, you know, we certainly take that under close advisement. But it's a coordinated effort. There's a lot of actors in Ukraine, both Ukrainian and international, at the government and non-governmental level. But we do everything we can to make sure that we're coordinating as best we can with from the UN agencies to the U.S. government agencies everywhere.
And when you are operating, let's say maybe not necessarily Ukraine, but somewhere where USAID might be having projects, or many years ago you worked for the Peace Corps and where they might be having projects, are they able to give you signals to say, well, we're doing this and this, but if you did that, batteries, say, that would really help? Do you get those kind of signals from federal agencies?
Yeah. I mean, I think the Peace Corps had, during COVID, I think they had to withdraw all the volunteers from around the world. So that was for the first time ever. So that wasn't a source of information. But in general, you're right. I think the U.S. government has a big footprint, very skilled, talented people who are living and experts in the country. So I think it's always a source of good information. And we do our best, I think, you know, anywhere that we're working, just to make sure that the embassy knows about what direct relief efforts are. If there's an event or something, typically a U.S. government official will be there. I mean, Ambassador Brzezinski in Poland has been terrifically both helpful and supportive of efforts to assist refugees in Poland. So we meet with him when we're over there, and he's come to events about direct relief activities in Poland. So we find it a great source of, I mean, it's a different role. I think, you know, we, as a private nonprofit, we have to maintain some distance, and that independence is important for a variety of reasons, just so there's no confusion primarily. But I think we do everything we can to make sure it's a coordinated effort, including with the UN agencies, which the embassy obviously does sure. as well.
We're speaking with Thomas Teig. He's CEO and president of Direct Relief. And what about the military side? Say you're trying to get, again, these battery power sources. And these are big, right? These are like the size of a telephone booth, I'm imagining, each individual Tesla battery pack. What about the military considerations and working around them? Because especially in Ukraine, you never know where action could happen.
Right. I think, you know, as a humanitarian group, we have to keep kind of a clear distance so there's no confusion about what our role is. So we're not supporting the warfighting capabilities of Ukraine, and that's consistent with our humanitarian character. But obviously, it is a war. I think we've worked closely, primarily with the Ukrainians, to make sure that they're safely and securely delivered so they're not targeted. So that, you know, we didn't make the announcement until after they were securely in Ukraine. But obviously, I think they're in touch with whoever they need to be at the military side. But we are not invited to those meetings, and we probably wouldn't go. And everyone understands that humanitarian groups, from a security perspective, need to know where the risks are, and so as to not put anyone in harm's way, but not to get too closely involved with the coordinating efforts, because that's really crosses a line that can be compromising to the perceived role of particularly a private NGO. So I think, again, it's a lot of coordination and disclosure on our part in attempting to make sure everyone knows, but staying clear and not expecting to be involved in anything that involves the military strategy or the campaign itself.
So that means in many cases your people might be at greater danger than they would be otherwise if they were operating under the auspices of military protection.
Yes and no. I mean, sometimes even with the Peace Corps, if you're perceived as a member of the armed forces in an active military campaign, you're targeted. If you're an innocent civilian just doing good work, I mean, you might be, but you know, from a strategic perspective, it's not particularly advantageous to go killing a bunch of people they're trying to help, even from the public posture. No one does that intentionally, right? But it's an important issue that we worry about, are concerned with, check in with the embassy, certainly before we send anyone there, as any visiting American does in Ukraine, and there are a lot of them who travel. But in terms of security, we're not kind of protected other than by the Ukrainian security that's arranged when we're going by typically the ministries of health or social welfare or whatever it might be. But it's a bit of a different role when you're there, you know, carrying an official passport from the U.S. government representing the government of the United States, as opposed to being there in a private capacity representing an organization. But we're still American, and we definitely, you know, check in and disclose what we're doing. And in Ukraine, for example, sometimes the USAID funding has ceased, and we have picked up some of the activities that USAID had been funding for the government of Ukraine just because of the timing of the appropriations or whatever the hangup may be. So it's loosely coordinated, but not officially coordinated, as is the case with the many nonprofits receive financial support from the U.S. government through USAID. Direct Relief, just for historical reasons, has always been privately funded.
Sure. And just a technical question. If you're delivering battery backups, you know, for healthcare facilities and hospitals, how do they get charged? Because a battery needs to be charged to be able to discharge. And if the power is out, what happens?
Well, the idea is to charge it when you do have power, so it's available when the power goes out. So they use nuclear power in Ukraine. I think when it's available, that's when you charge the battery, so it's available. In places, they were looking at adding a lot of solar, which we've done in a lot of places around the world. So typically, you know, our facility in California, it's 150,000 square feet and runs on a solar microgrid. So during the day, the batteries charge up while the sun's out, and we're generating our own energy, feeding some back to the grid. And when the sun goes down, we can draw down on the batteries. And depending on the climate and the sun availability, which in Ukraine is great during the summer. There's long days of sunlight. It's very bad during the winter, but there's enough to charge the batteries somewhat, but really depends on the climate. So it can be charged from any source, but the idea is to have the battery there for resiliency when the power goes out, often from a weather event, but actually in Ukraine, it's from the grid being targeted by the Russians, which is, again, a much different cause than a hurricane in the Caribbean, but has the same effect on really screwing up the delivery of healthcare systems for people who rely on them.
Thomas Tighe is CEO of Direct Relief. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tom.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, how to make sure you outlive your investments after you retire. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. No one avoids death and taxes, but you can make sure an element that's crucial to a comfortable retirement lasts the rest of your life. For what that is and how to preserve it, certified financial planner Art Stein of Arthur Stein Financial. All right, give us the big story. What needs to last the rest of your life?
Tom, federal retirees, or, you know, and let's talk about FERS retirees, they have two sources of income during retirement. And one, of course, is guaranteed income. And guaranteed income is Social Security and their FERS annuity. And those are great. They're guaranteed to last the rest of their life, and they both have cost of living adjustments. But most FERS retirees at some time during their retirement are going to have to start taking money from their investments to supplement their guaranteed income. And that's something that may happen to them, you know, as soon as they retire. It may be 5 or 10 years into retirement. Of course, one problem for FERS retirees is that anytime inflation is more than 2%, the purchasing power of their annuity declines. And for most FERS retirees, they're going to have to make that up by taking money from their investments.
But the investment, presumably it's a TSP. I mean, you've got to make the minimum withdrawal at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. But you don't have to spend it. You can reinvest it, you know, after you pay the taxes.
Got it.
So it means that they never have to worry about running out of money because they'll always have the guaranteed income. What they need to worry about is running out of investments. And that's when being too conservative over a long period of time can really hasten the day that people run out of investments, because the G fund, which is, you know, the most popular fund, and even the F fund, pretty much guaranteed to lose purchasing power once you take into account taxes and inflation. And that's also true of bank accounts. And lots of federal employees and retirees have very significant amounts in bank accounts. And those lose purchasing power over time, too. So let me just give you a really simple example. And the simplest example is just going to be about bank accounts. Let's say that you're going to give a party in 12 months. A couple is going to give a party in 12 months. And they estimate the cost of the party to be $1,000. So they want to be very prudent. So they take $1,000 and invest it in a bank account, money market fund. It's considered 100% safe, guaranteed by the federal government, and it does not fluctuate in value. So if they leave it in there for 12 months and they earn 2% simple interest, at the end of 12 months, they'll have $1,020. Now they have to pay tax on the interest. They paid $6 in tax, they'd have $1,014 left. So it sounds pretty good. They had a $1,000 party. Now they have $1,014. But we forgot to take into account inflation. If inflation's only 3%, the $1,000 party is now costing $1,030. They only have $1,014 after taxes, so they're $16 short. They lost purchasing power after taxes and inflation. Now, clearly in this example, not a big deal. It's only $16. It only compounds over, you know, 1 year. But many retirees have heard and read that when they're retired, and even as they approach retirement, they should have the majority of their money in bonds and bank accounts, which for the TSP means the G fund and the F fund. And for most TSP participants, it mainly means the G fund because they don't like the F fund so much.
Yeah, that's it's the preaching of safety, in other words, above all else.
Preaching safety above all else. And that's because those types of investments, when we say they're safer, that's very misleading, Tom. What they are is less volatile. And volatility is not the only investment risk. And really, for long-term investors, the most important retirement risk is taxes and inflation, reducing the purchasing power of their investments. It's very difficult because people put their money in the G fund and they see it gradually increase in value and they don't think about, well, is it keeping up with taxes and inflation? And many people, you know, really when they judge the amount of money they have, if they look at the amount in the TSP and say, I have $1 million and the TSP have got $1 million to spend. Well, of course, that's not true. It's $1 million minus taxes. So it's a much lower amount.
We're speaking with certified planner Art Stein of Arthur Stein Financial. I guess I'm still trying to get my mind around the idea of a $1,000 party. I guess in today's inflation, that means a case of Budweiser and four of your best friends at this point.
What other kind of party is there?
That's right. But if you take that million versus a thousand and you take your calculations out for 20, 25, 30 years, it's tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars you might be foregoing in intrinsic value of your investments that will never be there.
Absolutely. You know, I can tell you that, you know, with the cost of living adjustment for FERS retirees, if inflation were 3% a year, they're only going to get a 2% per year inflation adjustment. After 10 years, that would reduce the purchasing power of their annuity 8%. After 20 years, it would reduce it 17%. They're going to have to make up that difference.
So you really have to look at your future life and retirement, not so much from how many dollars are sitting in the different accounts, but what those accounts are doing, and also what you actually need to maintain your lifestyle.
Yes, and that's what, you know, retirement planning is all about, is looking, well, how much do I have? What kind of rate of return can I expect based upon, you know, what funds I'm invested in? And how much do I expect to spend in retirement? And this is where, again, I think a lot of people make a mistake. How long a retirement do I need to plan for? Now, none of us know how long we're going to live, but if we're healthy now and say we retire at 65, people need to assume that they're going to have a 30-year retirement at least, because many of us are going to live that long. And, you know, 10 years from now, medical care is going to be much better than it is now. And same thing true 20 and 30 years from now. Medical system, it's great at keeping us alive. And it means that we could live a very long time and be very healthy. And a lot of people don't think of it that way. I mean, I just spoke to a couple yesterday, and the wife is 82. And you know, I was explaining this, and she said, well, you know, I'm 82. How long a retirement do I need to plan for? And I said, well, how's your health? She said, well, I got some vision problems. Other than that, I'm 100% healthy. How long did your parents live? Well, my mom lived to 92. Well, her mother died 20 years ago. If her mother could live to 92 with the medical care they had 20 years ago, why couldn't she live another 10 or 15 years?
And just a practical question. Some people feel they need, and they do need, people need liquid assets. You might want to pay cash for a car or a vacation or something, and that would not be in your TSP because you don't want to try to withdraw the principal if you can avoid that. What is a good way to keep cash, or let's say not so much cash, but a liquid asset that you can turn to cash quickly because you have a legitimate call for it?
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody should have an emergency fund, which is not a great name for that because it sounds like something bad happened. A new car, I need to pay for a wedding for my son or daughter, or I want to give money to my grandkids. And, you know, banks are great for that. But you also want to make sure you don't have too much in low-yielding bank accounts. I mean, if you look around in today's world, you can find online bank accounts that are paying 5.25%. But many people are letting money just sit in their local bank account and getting 0.25%, 0.5%, 1%. That's a big loss.
Then with respect to your TSP distributions, you can always change the distribution if you want to. You may not get that 25 years worth of better growth, but you can get better growth while you're at it.
Yeah. And money, you know, you expect to take out and spend in the next 3 or 4 years. I mean, the G fund is a good place for that. And the F fund in most normal years is also a good place for that. The stock funds, CS and I, the money that's in there is money that you would need 10, 20, 30 years from now, because stocks are much more volatile than bonds. But over long periods of time, historically, stocks have outperformed bonds by enough to make it worthwhile to put up with the bad years.
Good advice for making sure you can have that $1,030 party. Certified planner Art Stein of Arthur Stein Financial. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. 57 past the hour. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. Up next, the top national headlines from CBS News and the Federal Newscast. I'm Tom Temin.
The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Thursday, March 28th, 2024, 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Temin. Our producers are Eric White and Peter Masurlian, our digital editors Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up in this hour of The Federal Drive, how to do foreign aid if you're a private organization without stepping on federal toes. Plus, new rules take effect for agencies buying from Ability One contractors. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of the Federal Drive. But first, the Defense Department has wrapped up the 9th iteration of its Global Information Dominance Experiment, GUIDE. Now, earlier GUIDE exercises delivered what they call a minimum viable capability for the Combined Joint All-Domain Command and Control System. You with us still? The department is now putting the new capability in this mouthful to the test. Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis has the latest. All right, JADC2, the combined version of it. Everyone knows JADC2. They've been working on it for years now. The minimum capability for it is up and running. What does that mean?
Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks, she said last month during the CDAO symposium that a minimum viable capability for CJADC2 was up and running. It was ready to be used out in the field. And during the GUIDE series last year, they were testing out a mix of tools. And by they, I don't just mean combatant commands. It's combatant commands, it's the military branches, the joint force, and all allies and partners. So last year, during those exercises, it was GUIDE 5 through GUIDE 7. They were developing streamlined staff processes so commands could collaborate, and they were testing out software. Ultimately, that led to the delivery of the minimum viable capability for CJADC2. Here's Air Force Colonel Matthew Strohmeyer. He leads GUIDE exercises at the CDAO on the kinds of things that they were working through during those exercises.
So we went through a process of learning from GUIDE 5 through GUIDE 8 that started with GUIDE 5 asking a question: can we conduct joint force experimentation to field things at scale across the department? We learned, yes, we can do that. And then GUIDE 6 and 7 really looked to refine the thing that we were trying to field, or this heterogeneous mix of things that we were trying to field, to be able to get an actual JADC2 capability out into the field. And then Guide 8 was really our delivery event where we said, did we actually, were we able to successfully deliver something that warfighters said, yes, this is helping me. This is helping the things I need to do every day.
So in other words, the guide is a set of exercises in which they try out what they're developing. That's called JADC2. Is that a good way to put it?
Yes. And also, Deputy Secretary Hicks, she revived those exercises because they kind of elapsed a couple of years ago. And then during the establishment of the CDAO, they started it again.
Okay. Nothing like a CDAO to get things going. Now, they have this minimum capability. I guess they could send a bit from point A to point B, maybe. What's next in this process of getting to more than minimum capability?
Now it's all about expanding and bringing in more programs, bringing in more contractors, international allies and partners. And the CDAO just wrapped up Guide 9 last week. This exercise was conducted alongside the Army's exercise called Project Convergence. So they're bringing in more people. One of the things that they were able to do during this exercise was to successfully demonstrate a vendor-agnostic data integration layer for the first time, making data extensible across various operational systems. First of all, let me say that Craig Martell, he's the CDAO's chief, he said his main goal, one of his main goals, is to have data mesh in place. And data mesh is all about interoperability. It's all about transparency of data and the ability to transport it. And initiatives like CJADC2 are the reason why there is a need for data mesh. And what they were able to do, they were able to test out data mesh services. They basically break it down into two levels. The strategic level and the operational or tactical level. But being able to demonstrate this vendor agnostic data integration level is a significant step. And it also means that this data that they're now able to collect, it can now be fed into the DoD's development pipeline, which will help to train that next round of AI models, which is the CDAO after. Here's the CDAO's Strohmeyer again.
We did successfully just demonstrate in this last guide for the first time ever a completely vendor agnostic data integration layer that allowed us to be able to bring that data down. It didn't matter what vendor was using it, how they were using it. That data was created and was extensible across any of the operational systems that we're using, and now it is ready to start piping over into the development pipeline, into Alpha 1 and other capabilities so that we can start learning on it at scale as an enterprise. So that's one of the things we really want to get after this year, is to start making that pipeline permanent, persistent, and real so we can start training those models.
All right, so they have sources of data, now they can share the data, and now they can apply the data to something important, which is training their AI models. Now, the CDAO is building these AI capabilities across the Defense Department. Does the guide exercise help in that effort also?
Yes, it does. In fact, guide exercises are that experimentation venue for the services to test out different AI capabilities. During the last guide, they did a blind test, and they gave half the team a generative AI capability for logistics tasks. So they were supposed to use that capability to analyze the logistics of moving some sustainment capability from one location to another. Another half of the team didn't have that tool, so they were able to compare that side by side. And that's actually where Task Klima comes in. It's a task force that is led by the CDAO, and they want to integrate AI tools across the DoD. Here's Colonel Strohmeyer again.
And the difference was, this wasn't research organizations. This was actual warfighters that were doing this and seeing what worked, what didn't work as they went through the process. So that's one example of how we're really partnered with them to get very quick results and to show, are we actually testing these things appropriately? Are they actually being effective?
And they must have a squadron of people on the guide exercises with spreadsheets to keep track of all the names and acronyms of the organizations involved here and the different programs. Anyhow, they did try it out in the AI context during a guide. Any results that they could report?
The team found generative AI to be useful and valuable. Colonel Strohmeyer says it's not a panacea, but it's also not that Pandora's box of evil. for use cases such as content retrieval, especially when it comes to dealing with open source information, large language models are really helpful. Also, initial content creation is a pretty good use case where large language models are useful. Here's Colonel Strohmeyer.
The rapid creation of information for a commander to be able to distill down what's going on in this area, that takes hundreds and hundreds of hours at combatant commands. And so one of the ways that we've seen promise is taking that day-to-day mission that's required to get that information up there and using things like generative AI to get initial hack at, you know, what's going on, what's the information, doing it in a way that we can see what sources were pulled on to be able to generate that information, and then have the human kind of curate it and edit it after that. That's another use case that we're seeing a lot of promise in.
Right. So you wouldn't ask it to say, what time should I invade China? That's probably a little bit ambitious. Are there more guides coming up then?
We don't know the exact dates, but they are usually 90 days apart.
Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And be sure to check out her story. She'll guide you all through it at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come, new rules take effect for agencies buying from Ability One contractors. This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.